This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Thank God it's Friday!
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
We will make America great again.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS to speak your mind. Now, First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, look at this. With all the accusations flying against our current commander-in-chief, we're finding out more about what the Obama administration did and did not do about Russian attempts to hack the U.S. election, and even more about when they found out about it. Welcome to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and your emails are welcome. And our rule is naysayers go to the head of the line. That applies every day of the week. But on First Amendment Fridays, we open up the lines for every concern. Every issue under the sun is welcome. Just keep it clean for the FCC. At 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. We now find out that former Obama officials choked on the Russian attempts to hack the U.S. election, saying they didn't do enough to stop them, and the only public warning was a memo. We'll get into that in a moment. Kids are not working the same summer jobs they used to. Might be a change in attitude, or perhaps there's another cause behind the shrinking numbers. A new poll says the majority of Americans do not approve of the Congress. What a surprise. Dr. Matthew Spaulding at Hillsdale is going to join me to tell us how we can make the Congress great again. And New York Times bestselling author Don Winslow is going to join me to talk about his new book, The Force, which is already being made into a movie. And a woman who went blind at the age of 26 will have surgery to restore her sight. I'll give you the details. It's exciting stuff. And what would you do if you got the family packed for a nice camping trip over the 4th of July holiday, only to find out the park you're going to is closed because the state didn't get its budget passed? And please cast your vote in my quick poll. You'll find a brand new question put up at LarsLarson.com every single night of the week. Is actor Johnny Depp's assassination comment a threat against the life of President Trump? Do we have that handy? I'm not in the studio today. I'm at my favorite gun store called Northwest Armory, nwarmory.com. If you've got that soundbite of Johnny Depp, I'd like to hear people hear exactly what this creep had to say about Donald Trump. And the fact is, the audio is a little sketchy because it was shot, I think, on a cell phone by a member of the crowd. This is Johnny Depp at a little event that was being held, believe it or not, at a drive-in movie theater. But take a listen to what he had to say about President Donald Trump and assassination. If we have the soundbite. Now, if we don't have the soundbite right now, we'll get to that a little bit later, and I'll share it with you then. At 866-HEY-LARS, that's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can follow me on Twitter @LarsLarsonShow and on Facebook @TheLarsLarsonShow. Now, here's the report that I mentioned a moment ago. Senior Obama officials lament that they did not do enough to stop Russian attempts to influence the 2016 election. The Washington Post rolled that report out this morning. Former President Barack Obama's handling of the response to Russia's attempts have come under intense scrutiny from Republicans and Democrats. The only public warning of the Russian government's efforts came in an October 7th memo, barely a month before the election, from the Director of National Intelligence ascribing DNC committee hacks to Russia. Another senior administration official, however, admitted to the WAPO that the response to Russian actions in the election is the hardest thing about my entire life in government to defend. I feel we sort of choked. In other words, for all the Democrats' concern about whether or not there was Russian hacking of the election, they knew about this a long time ago. They knew about it before the election, and they didn't do much of anything about it. By the way, does CNN have any room to call Fox News state TV, given their coverage of the Obama administration? CNN anchor John King blasted Fox News' morning show as state TV today as he accused Fox's Ainsley Earhart of throwing President Trump's softball questions in a new interview. King made the comment after airing a clip of the interview from Fox and Friends where Trump explained his recent declaration that he had no tapes of his conversations with former FBI Director James Comey. Trump implied on Twitter weeks ago that he could have recorded Comey. As Trump answered, Earhart added that she believed Trump's tactic was a smart way to make sure that Comey stayed honest in his hearings. Let's set aside the tough probing questions on state TV here. We haven't actually heard the president's entire story, have we? Let me tell you what I think about all of this to-do over the last 6 weeks about President Trump and his comment. What he actually said on Twitter was, James Comey had better hope that I don't have tapes of the conversation. He never claimed to have tapes. And it's the kind of, I think, trash talk that somebody might expect if you had a dispute with somebody and there was a question about which one of you was telling the truth and you said, you better hope I don't have tapes of that conversation. You're not saying you do have tapes. You're just saying you better hope I don't. I think it is a good way to ensure that somebody stays honest because, after all, we have people in politics who are not telling us the entire story at times. And James Comey, it turns out, I think is a highly deceptive, highly dishonest former public official. My evidence of that? He leaked information illegally to the New York Times. For all we know, because he leaked once, he may have leaked a number of other times. The Trump administration has seen itself beset by leaks over the last several months, and we all wondered who was positioned high enough in the bureaucracy to have access to that information. Well, James Comey could be one answer. Who would have had a motivation to act against President Trump by leaking information to the press? Turns out James Comey would be a good answer to that question. So if you wonder why President Trump was suggesting to Comey, you better be honest about what you're saying because I might have tapes. Well, he mildly suggested that. I don't think it was a bad way to send a message to Comey. Tell the truth or there might be consequences. I think truth and consequences are something that we ought to be seeing more of from our federal government these days. By the way, I mentioned that story about the woman who went blind at age 26. She is going to be able to see again with help from her teeth, believe it or not. Honor Davis, 65 years old, from Northern Ireland, lost her sight almost 40 years ago due to a rare skin and eye disorder, a pioneering surgery which involves placing a tooth of hers into her eyes. Sounds like hocus pocus, but apparently it works. She was suddenly unable to see her six-month-old daughter, Carrie, when she was struck down with Stevens-Johnson syndrome. The condition, which is often brought on by medication, has a 15% death rate. The procedure, called osteoodontokeratoprosthesis, involves the reconstruction of a new eye using a tiny plastic lens and one of the patient's own teeth. The lens is inserted into a hole drilled through the tooth, which is later implanted in the eye. Believe me, it sounds strange to me, but if it gets this lady her sight back, that's a fantastic development. Hey, by the way, Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price. I use Harry's razors every morning, and I have for years. And that's one reason 3 million guys have switched to Harry's. Jeff and Andy are the guys behind all this. They started Harry's to fix shaving. They bought their own German factory, and along with it, they got 100 years of blade-making experience to ensure the highest quality. All products backed by their 100% quality guarantee. They took a little less profit. They sold directly to customers like me over the internet. Harry's offers its blades at half the usual price of razors in the pharmacy. Great news, Harry's is so confident you'll love their blades, they'll give you their trial set for free. Just cover shipping. Your free trial set includes the Truman Set ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade. They'll include shave gel, a travel blade cover, and post-shave balm. It's worth about $20. And all you have to do is cover a few bucks for shipping. Get started with Harry's today and get their free trial offer. Almost a $20 value free of charge. All you cover is a few dollars for shipping. To get your free trial set, including the handle, blade, shave gel, and post-shave balm, go to harrys.com right now. Enter my name, Lars, at checkout. That's harrys.com, code word Lars. Don't wait. Get started with a great shave at Harry's today, the way I do every morning. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday evening. Glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. Couple of things I want to mention to you. One, thanks again for the wonderful welcome to Louisiana for our broadcast this last Monday from WBRP Studios. And thanks again for the wonderful panel with my fellow talk shows hosts down there, Clarence Bugs and Bill Profita and Kevin Gallagher as well. Second thing I wanted to mention is two Republican state lawmakers in Connecticut have sent a letter to Trinity College demanding the firing of Professor Johnny Williams. Guess what this joker did? He wrote an article arguing that first responders should not have aided the victims of the recent congressional shooting, the attempted political assassination of Representative Steve Scalise. The article was titled, "Let Them Blanking Die," using a word I don't use on the radio. Williams included the title as a hashtag in subsequent posts. "Professor Williams' opinions are simply outrageous and racist in and of themselves," write the Republican lawmakers. "We would urge you to consider this request in the best interest of not only members of the Greater Trinity Community College, but of society at large." Can you believe there are academics out there that behave this way and say these kinds of things? Let's go to Tony, who's on the phone in Nevada. Hey, Tony, thanks for listening on KKFT. What's on your mind?
Yes, I remember back in the 40s, 50s, even early 60s, if the authorities found out that you were high on drugs, they'd just pick you up, take you over to a center, throw you in a rubber room until you dried out, and they won't let you go until they know you can return back to society.
I'm a fan of dry out sentences. They may work better, though, for alcohol, but I have a feeling for some of these drugs like methamphetamine and heroin, the dry out sentence alone is not going to get them off the drugs. They'll go right back to it the minute they hit the street.
Yeah, but the experience will make them think twice.
Yes, it would, and I would imagine detoxing in a cell somewhere in the jail is probably a real incentive not to go back to it, although those drugs do have a powerful pull. But I'm not in favor of, you know, providing some kind of drug treatment through Medicaid. Not at all. Tony, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Nick in Mississippi. Nick, thanks for listening on the Super Talk Network. What's on your mind on a First Amendment Friday night?
I was just curious. On the campaign trail, Trump said, if elected, that there would be no stopping Hillary. But then he said, well, the Second Amendment people may have a solution. So that's a pretty clear implication that if elected, she should be assassinated.
I remember that comment at the time, and I remember that there was a different context to it than the one you remember. But we can choose to differ on that one. I understand what you're saying, but I could go back and look up the history of that one. That one faded a little bit from my memory. I remember when he said it, and I remember questioning at the time, what did he mean? And I looked at the broader context of what he had to say, and he was not suggesting the assassination of Hillary Clinton. But
What else could he be suggesting?
I think that he was talking about the Second Amendment issues because we were talking about whether or not he was talking about whether or not gun legislation was going to get through the Congress. But if you want me to go back and look, I'll take a look at it, Nick. I think even at the time that even the major media who were inclined to believe anything bad about Donald Trump that they ever could have suggested to him, even they concluded that it was not a threat of assassination. But I guess that doesn't change the fact that now Donald Trump is president, and now people like Johnny Depp and Madonna have been saying things that threaten the life of the American president, which is a federal crime.
What they said is wrong, but it seems like conservatives hold actors to a higher standard than the president.
No, not a higher standard. Every single American citizen, every person in this country is told if you threaten the life of the president, it's a federal crime. That's not a higher standard. It's the same standard for you or me. I don't let people on this show. I will dump a call if somebody threatens the life of a member of Congress, and I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. I don't let that happen on my program. And if you threaten the life of the president, it's a federal crime. That's not a higher standard. That is the very same standard. We're joined now by Matt Spaulding, who's the Associate Vice President and Dean of Education at Hillsdale College. Matt, it's good to have you back on the program.
Great to be with you, Lars. How are you?
Listen, I'm doing very well, and I want you to talk a little bit about this brand new poll about whether or not Americans think that Donald Trump can get the things done and whether or not the Congress is doing its job.
Well, you know, the piece here I'm most worried about is Congress. I think that confidence in the president is going to go down if he doesn't accomplish things. But he's gotten to the point where, in order to accomplish things, he needs Congress to get its act together. And the way I see it, the weakest branch right now is the legislative branch. And they're not exerting their power, which I think they have a lot of. It's very, very frustrating. And I think it's potentially going to bog this administration down. And coming to midterms, who knows what position that puts them in, because there are enough seats up in the districts that didn't vote for Donald Trump that are held by Republicans that you could have a problem.
Yeah, you could. So, Matt, tell me this. Do you think that the Republicans are failing to do what they could do now with majorities in both houses because they simply can't get their act together? Or do you think there's actually some, I guess I'd have to say, covert resistance to the Trump administration? People like Paul Ryan and others who could be pushing a whole lot harder who've decided, I just don't want to help this president because they never liked him to begin with. Tell me, what do you think is motivating?
Well, I don't think it's a covert anti-Trumpism. I think what it is two things. One is I think they're very risk averse. Look, these guys have not had to actually legislate with a cooperative president for 8 years. I think this majority does not have that experience. The vast number of the members weren't elected under Bush, right? They don't know what it's like to have a Republican president, number one. And number two, I think actually, to some extent, if they have some disagreements with Trump, that should actually help the situation. Because if that's the case, then they should step up to the plate and pass a budget and do some things. So I really don't quite understand it. I don't think it's a problem with Trump. There's plenty of agreement on the agenda. I think part of it is, I think it has something to do with the nature of the modern Congress itself, which has largely shaped itself to the administrative state. And I'll tell you one thing in particular that I'm increasingly frustrated by, which is the House is now shaping things in order to get around an arcane rule in the Senate called the filibuster.
Yep, let's get rid of it.
Which is preventing things from happening.
What do you think about dumping the filibuster altogether? I know that there are consequences down the line, but as far as I'm concerned, Matt, I'm talking to Dr. Matt Spaulding, by the way, from Hillsdale College, great college in D.C., and also in Hillsdale, Michigan. But here's the thing that frustrates me. We always hear about people being disenfranchised. Am I not, as an American, disenfranchised if my representatives in Congress say, well, we could pass a bill with 51 votes, but we're not going to pass it unless we have 60? So in other words, a minority of members of Congress can hold up a piece of legislation indefinitely, and that means the majority is being disenfranchised, are they not?
Look, the larger disenfranchisement is that the United States Congress, which is the popular branch of government, is not doing its constitutional duty, which is to do things like budget. It's a real practical problem. But here's the other thing that's the misnomer in this whole debate over the filibuster. We can solve the filibuster problem tomorrow without changing the filibuster rules. You don't need to get rid of the filibuster. There are enough rules in place and enough things that the majority can do, namely the majority leader can do, with the agreement of his party, that they could actually enforce the filibuster, make it a real filibuster. The Democrats won't hold out long enough to do that, but you keep the thing in place so in the future, if there's something you really want to filibuster, you could do it. The problem today is that the minority can now use it not because they object to some fundamental thing. They have the right to do that, and they can continue to debate and continue to deliberate. And if it's a high-pressure issue, you could stop it. But the problem now is they're using it just like I object and everything stops and that legislation is gone.
Doesn't make any sense. Dr. Matthew Spaulding from Hillsdale, thank you very much.
The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday. We'll get back to your call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the program for the first time Don Winslow, who's the New York Times bestselling author of 20 novels, including the blockbuster The Cartel and now most recently The Force. Stephen King describes Don Winslow's new book, The Force, as the Godfather, only with cops. Ms. Winslow, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Appreciate it.
So is that a fair description of your new book?
I think it's one fair description, certainly. Listen, I'm thrilled to get that kind of notice from someone like Stephen King, you know. But I think that the book explores a lot of aspects about cops.
Yeah, and in fact, we end up talking about police a lot on the program. Obviously, there are incidents around America that cause those discussions to come up. But tell me about the issues you try to get to in these novels.
You know, first of all, I mean, the book is dedicated to 178 police officers who were killed in the United States just during the time I was writing the book. So I feel we should acknowledge those men and women and by name, you know. This book deals with a special unit, a fictional unit inside the New York Police Department that's charged with getting guns and drugs off the street in Upper Manhattan. And they do that very well, and it's particularly about one of these guys, Denny Malone. But they go wrong. They make the biggest heroin bust in the history of New York City and take half the drugs and money for themselves. And the story goes on from there.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. I remember one of the first stories I covered as a reporter was about exactly that situation where they had a drugs and vice unit, and the guys in the vice unit, for real, this really happened. They'd been in it so long that they decided, you know, we're not really well compensated and we're not really recognized for what we do. And so when we hit a drug dealer and he's got 40 grand in the safe, 20 grand makes it to the evidence room and the other 20 doesn't. And that there's a kind of a, I know that they were trying to get a kind of a moral equivalency, saying society doesn't value us very highly and these guys are dirtbags anyway, so we're going to put some of this in our own pockets. And I think they saw sort of a moral message in that, that they would get their extra compensation from the bad guys, which in some ways, I'm not even sure the public would necessarily generally disagree with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, you know, and I'm not without empathy for these characters, by the way. You know, I get it. I understand that temptation, and I've had cops tell me, you know, very straight cops tell me, you know, the only reason I haven't done it is I was afraid I'd get caught.
Well, the other thing the cops I'm familiar with had done in that case that I covered was they took a certain amount of the drugs and they put them in their pockets, not to resell, but to make sure that when they raided somebody who they knew was dirty, and they knew it,
right,
the way everybody, you know, if you're a cop and you say, do you know that guy's dirty? Yeah. And when you bust him, are you sure you're going to find drugs in his pocket? Yeah, they were sure they were going to find drugs in his pocket, because if they weren't there
yeah,
to begin with, they're going to put them there. And that's real stuff.
They're going to put them there, yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely real. Or, you know, a lot of these cops in these drug units travel around with small amounts of heroin in order to give them to their snitches, who are usually addicts, you know, and either to bribe them, you know, to give them information, or to help them out if they're, you know, in serious withdrawal.
So how do we decide, you know, I mean, I know you're taking this from a fictional standpoint, but how do, mm-hmm, we decide what is the right way to go after the bad guys, especially when the bad guys operate with no rules and the cops operate under an increasingly tight web of rules that hamstring them almost from the moment they walk out of the precinct?
I think those are really tough decisions, you know, because we have contradictory, almost schizophrenic expectations of our police forces. On the one hand, we want perfect safety, but on the other hand, we want total freedom. On the one hand, we want perfect security, but on the other hand, we want perfect privacy. We want to get bad guys off the streets, and yet we create, you know, all of these rules and situations that make it, in some cases, virtually impossible. So I think a lot of times society is a little hypocritical about this. And, you know, like laws, we don't kind of want to know how sausages really get made.
No, in fact, I'm talking to Don Winslow, who's the author most recently of The Force. So you make a lot of your characters a little morally ambiguous then.
I do, because I find that more interesting. You know, I think it's kind of dull to write a simplistic character, and I think it's probably duller to read a simplistic character. I like dealing with moral conflicts and guys who are struggling to figure out what is the right thing to do. And sometimes who choose to do the wrong thing, but sometimes for the right reasons.
Yeah, and when they do that, or are there a lot of characters who go into police work intending to do the right thing every time, every single day of the week, and then they find themselves sort of slowly, inexorably being sucked into the quicksand of the moral ambiguity of the people they have to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're dead on, Lars. I just call it erosion. You know, this character in this book, Denny Malone, has been on the force for 18 years. He's seen most of everything. He's experienced the sort of heartbreaks of seeing victims. And, you know, one thing that I think the public doesn't realize a lot is how much cops really care about the victims, how much they take that home. We tend to think that the principal relationship in law enforcement is between cop and criminal. It's not really the case. It's between cop and victim. And I think sometimes that sort of erosion of seeing that over and over again does lead cops to cut corners, you know, cheat on warrants, cheat on evidentiary things in order to put guys they know for a fact are going to hurt people if they're on the outside.
Well, imagine being that officer who straps on a gun and puts on a uniform every day and then goes out and meets up personally with the folks who've been the victims, you know, either the mother of a dead child.
That's right.
And then they say, I'll go out and I'll get that guy. And they find, I'm one just tiny little gnat's hair short of getting this guy.
Right.
And if I can just kind of bridge that one, maybe if I have to cut a corner to get that bad guy, I've created a moral good out of that.
No, and listen, I have a hard time arguing against that. I had cops tell me, you know, that they knew a guy, for instance, is beating up his girlfriend regularly, but they can't go in unless she calls for them. So one cop would go around the back of the place and yell for help. Then the other cop could testify in court, I heard someone yell for help and I went through the door. I had other cops tell me that they went to houses, you know, where a woman was getting beaten up or a child abused, knowing that they were going to be back the next time on the homicide call. And those cases haunt those guys for life.
How do you find yourself received in the police ranks when you go down to do some research?
You know, it varies, of course. But most of the cops were really very, very cooperative and generous with me.
Are they willing to be, you know, sort of candid with you if they get to know you and say, look, we're going to tell you how it really works, understanding that they may be running a risk by doing that?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty clean about protecting my sources. But you hit on it. It's over the course of time. It's like any other relationship. You need to spend time with it. You need to build a relationship, build a rapport. And for them to understand that you're truly interested in what they think and how they feel, and you're not necessarily looking to hang them out to dry.
See, that's the thing I wonder about, because if you're a cop, think about the sewer they swim in every day. They're out there dealing with people who are constantly double dealing on each other, and sometimes the CIs they have to deal with that double deal on them. So if you're used to an environment, I mean, most of us operate in an environment where everybody's honest. You go to one of your editors and he tells you something's going to happen, it happens. And we very rarely, in fact, that's why I think we're more outraged when we run into somebody who goes south on us, because they say, hey, most people honor their agreements, but the cops operate in an environment where almost everybody is double dealing.
And they come to a psychology where they think that everybody's lying all the time, you know, and it's extremely dangerous. But they're also dealing in an environment where information is currency. You know, it's currency between a CI and them, but it's also currency from cop to cop. Cops keep secrets even from cops, because all information is money and it's power.
His latest book is called The Force, and of course, he's the author of The Cartel. The Force is already being made into a movie. Congratulations, Don, and thanks so much for the time with us. We'll have you back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the time. It was fun. I appreciate it.
And Don, I won't double deal you on that promise. You will be back on the program. Don Winslow, New York Times bestselling author. You've got The Lars Larson Show.
Naysayers always go to the head of the line on The Lars Larson Show.
The remainder of the day.
Northwest Armory. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. We're live at Northwest Armory today for a First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you. I'll get to your calls in just a moment, but I want an update from Virginia Painter, who acts as the communications person for the Washington State Parks and Recreation Department. Ms. Painter, thanks for taking the time to come on today and tell me this. If the state of Washington, if the legislature now, and I think triple overtime, does not come up with a budget by this time next week, are you telling me that the state parks in Washington state are going to shut down?
That is correct. The Constitution of our state requires that if there's no budget in place by June 30th, then state services shut down on July 1. That includes state parks.
Can you describe how that process is going to work? Do you start on Friday and just start turning the keys and turning off the light switches and locking people out on the 4th of July weekend?
Well, it has to start a little bit before that, but the public won't see that part. If we are so unlucky as to get to that point, the park managers will have started doing some of the background work before, but visitors will still be in the park, of course. And then on the 30th, they won't allow any new people in because we've got campers in there that we need to help get them packed up and out of the park early on Friday so that park staff has the remainder of the day to mothball things, close systems down, shut down buildings, electrical systems, all of that kind of thing. So it takes some time, and it has to be done, you know, by midnight, and then the parks would be closed on July 1.
Can I call you Virginia?
Yes, please.
Virginia, call me Lars. Virginia, what do you expect is going to be the reaction of some of those taxpayers and or visitors to the state of Washington when they're told on Friday morning to pack your stuff, throw your tent in the car, and get out of here on Friday morning?
Well, you know, I don't, of course, nobody thinks this is fun, I'm sure, but by that point, people will know, and we've done our best to alert the customers who have reservations that go through that time. So hopefully they will have gotten an email notification, and park staff will be talking to people as we wait. We'll still be waiting for, you know, if we don't have a budget deal by then, we'll still be waiting to hear, but there'll be notification as people come into the park those last few days while we're waiting, and we'll be posting notices and so forth. But, you know, it's serious because most of us don't get that much vacation, or we have to plan ahead pretty far for it. So it is a place where people can feel the pain if there is not a budget by then.
You've got people who right now are hearing this. They may be hearing it for the first time, and they're thinking, but the whole family planned to go for 4th of July weekend at one of the 125 state parks, and does that mean that they may not know whether to pack all that camping gear in the car as late as Wednesday or Thursday night?
And that is the question, and that's what we're all waiting to see what happens here. But we're just trying to do the best we can to alert people and also to assure folks that if they've got a reservation and they're pretty set on going, keep your reservation in place, because if it should happen that there's a shutdown, all of those reservation-related interruptions to vacations would be fully refunded. And, of course, that doesn't make up for it all, but at least no one's going to lose their money over it. So we're kind of encouraging people to leave things in place and, you know, plan on going, but check the website as the days approach, because we'll be keeping that updated as best we can, you know, to let people know what's going on.
Virginia, I asked the state of Oregon if they were in the same boat, because they are also have a dysfunctional legislature that can't figure out how to pass a budget. They still don't have a budget. Washington doesn't have a budget. But they say they're going to use a continuing resolution, much like Congress does, where they pass a bill out of the House and Senate, and it flies to the governor, and the governor signs it, and then they operate on under the previous budget at the same rates, you know, employees still get paid and all that, and they go ahead and operate, and they said, we will not be shutting down even if the state of Oregon does not have a budget. Does Jay Inslee and do the legislators have the ability to pass an ongoing resolution, say sometime this weekend or early next week, so that things could go on uninterrupted, or is that not possible under the Washington Constitution?
Well, I don't really know the nuances of that, but what I do know is that if that were to happen, it would be very costly, very confusing, because you've got timelines that you have to follow as an agency to alert contractors to let employees know. So you have to basically do all that again, and it's pretty labor-intensive. So I don't really know if it's technically something that they would do or if it's a good idea.
Let me push back on that a little bit, because from time to time we hear about school districts that where the contract runs out, the two sides are still at each other's throats, and they haven't come up with an agreement, and they agree to operate under the existing agreement going on into the future in maybe 30 or 60-day increments. That's not possible. If other local agencies do that and continue to operate under the old, you know, the old budget and the old agreement, why would that not be possible for something like state parks as we head up to a really important American holiday?
Well, what I'm saying is I don't know. That's not really in my that's not really my job, and I really don't know the technical answers to that, so I really can't answer.
See, I'd love to lay this at Jay Inslee's feet and the leadership of the House and Senate. Say, if you folks just, you know, fly a bill through, if you can't get the whole budget done, just let people continue to operate and have a decent holiday weekend. And not, because it's one thing for the state, if they finally pass his budget at midnight on Thursday night, they say, fine, you guys can all do it. Mom and Dad are at home in bed, and they haven't even packed the car because they thought, well, we're shut down. They don't have a budget yet. So, you know, 4th of July is messed up for us. And holding people to the last second seems like a really lousy way to treat citizens and visitors.
Well, let's just hope for the best. What we're doing is we're hoping for the best, planning for the worst. So I'm still optimistic. I'm still hoping, and I think we are in general hoping that this will not be a problem when it comes to the first day of the new biennium.
Well, let's hope not. Ms. Painter, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time today. Let's go to Nancy in Edmonds. Hey, Nancy, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
It's about the threats of violence that celebrities like Johnny Depp and Madonna and Kathy Griffin and those actors in Central Park have been making against the president.
Yes.
I want people to understand that these are not comments that are protected under the First Amendment. They are committing a crime. They really, I think you said they should receive a visit from Secret Service agents.
At the very least.
I was going to say FBI agents.
When you're in a certain position, like standing in the airport line, or if you're a big Hollywood celebrity, you don't go out and threaten the life of the President of the United States, because as you point out, Nancy, correctly, it is a federal crime to threaten the President or his family or the Vice President or the Secretary of State and a number of other offices. Nancy, thanks a lot. I appreciate you listening. It's First Amendment Friday, live from Northwest Armory today.